Anatomy of a Worldview, Part 2, the second talk in a series on Foundations of Knowing the Truth, was presented by R. Wesley Hurd on October 8, 1991, at McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side. The following recording was made in a classroom setting, and some of the students' questions were inaudible. It is hoped that Dr. Hurd's answers will be sufficient to understand the context.
This is the second session on what I've entitled The Anatomy of a Worldview. I want to start out tonight by giving us a little bit of a context for this. I felt last week, after I got away from class, I felt like it was just, I don't know, a little bit out of the blue. Maybe it just seemed a little flat to me from what I really, the spirit of what I wanted to communicate to you. And this week I thought I would start by saying that I want to give you a little bit of my own thinking, my own passion, as it were, for why I would even want to teach something like this or think that it's worthy of being taught. That is the idea of a worldview. We're talking about just a concept. So maybe what I could do as I start off tonight is give you a context of how I think about this idea of a worldview and how it fits into the what I would call sort of the total picture of being Christian or desiring to be Christian, to have faith and to want to do and to be what, as best I can figure out, what it is that God wants me to do in this world and to be in this world. And a couple of different components for this, for me, come from just, for example, starting in the book of Romans in chapter 12. If you're familiar with that passage at all, you're aware of the fact that Paul has preached the gospel and clarified the gospel primarily up through chapter 8. And then he goes 9, 10, 11 and clarifies some more questions primarily about Israel. When he gets to chapter 12, he switches gears again. It's like he goes into 15th gear. And he's basically saying, okay, now what should our response to this be? What is the this? The this is the mercy and kindness of God toward us who rebelled and who have become creatures worthy of death as a result of rebellion. How should we respond to this incredible kindness of God? And the first verse in that chapter talks about, it says, I urge you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. The language we see here, we don't have time to unpack it completely, but the whole idea is he's suggesting that once we see the mercy of God and what a great thing it is that he's doing on our behalf and what he's done for us, what's an appropriate way to respond? And he takes some language very laden with sacrificial, the Hebrew religious and sacramental, liturgical, sacrificial system, and he turns it on its head. Whereas in the past, what Israel was taught was to respond to the mercy of God by making a thank offering, by getting a pigeon in the temple or a grain offering or something like that, and laying out as a sacrifice thanks to God for his mercy. Paul says, by contrast to that, I say, present yourself as a living being, and that will be an appropriate sacrifice. Now he goes on to say what he means by that. He's saying, presenting yourself to simply live out what God is going to do in your life, to present yourself to the purposes of God as a living creature, unto God's purposes, that is an appropriate response. And he's contrasting it with the idea of a ceremonial kind of response. And he's saying, I think at least he's saying, this is a more vital, more appropriate, and more. And he goes on in the second verse to talk about how, well, actually, it's in the first verse, the spiritual service of worship, that language right there in that phrase, contains within it the idea that this living your life to the purposes of God as He is bringing out His mercy in your life is the most correct, right-on, rational, appropriate response you could give to the gospel, to God's mercy. And then he goes on in the second verse and he says, and do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. I think he's simply now starting into a list of examples, exhortations, and ideas that flow from the major idea, the major premise that he set here is giving your life, living your life, presenting your life to the glory and goodness of God as He acts out His mercy in your life, as you trust Him. And one of the effects of that will be a transformed mind. The word that's used here is actually the idea of the renewing of a mind from the inside out. It's like a metamorphosis. And the imagery is very grand. He goes on in this chapter to talk about how changing our mind, the way we think, not the way the world thinks, but the way God thinks, in a sense, it's an appropriate response, it's an appropriate endeavor. It is a very high, practically speaking, it is a very, very high corollary, if you want to put it that way. A necessity, it seems, a logical necessity would be, if I'm going to be not conformed to the world, if I'm going to be presenting myself to the things of God, then it must be that my mind, how I think, is going to change. My mind will become, hopefully, closer and closer to the way God thinks. Or, to put it another way, the values that I hold dear will change slowly as God works in my life, such that my values will conform to God's values, my perspectives will conform to His perspectives. So one of the things behind the little bit of teaching that I do about the Christian worldview or the Christian mind or thinking as a Christian, my whole energy, all my energy and motive behind that is, this is a very high thing. This is a very important thing. It's not, in a sense, it's whether we take it on in a very aware kind of way, a very conscious kind of way, where I want to learn to think as a Christian, or whether we simply read the Bible and try to ascertain what God's saying and apply that stuff to our life in a much more ordinary, everyday kind of way, not being terribly conscious about it. I think both of them are the same thing. What you're going to find around the study center here, for good or ill, depending on your perspective, I suppose, is that we tend to want to correlate with, we want to relate to what's going on in the very secular university that we're sort of smacked up against, and so a lot of our stuff will end up being philosophical or academic because we want to try to meet that need where it is. But in other settings, it might be much less philosophical and much less academic, and it would be doing the same thing. I believe the Bible infers quite clearly that our rationality, which I talked a little bit about last week, our rationality, our ability to think at all, is a gift. But the thing that strikes me about it is that it seems to imply participation. This is a strange situation. I mean, if you stop and think about it for a minute, we have an omniscient, sovereign, loving Creator God who's calling all the shots. But here we are, these creatures who have this conscious ability to make choices. We have to make choices. We make choices every day. And we live out the consequences of those choices. And yet at the same time, the promise of the gospel is that in some mysterious way to us, unfathomable way to us, God is able to take our choices, even bad ones sometimes, and invert them into something that becomes, in the end, a good thing, in spite of us. The very idea that God has created this world and me, human beings, in a way that we actually, in a very real way, participate with Him The fact that I think and that I must think and that I learn and that I must learn, if you stop and think about it, are very interesting things. In other words, God expects, He created us to be thinkers, He created us to be participators, to take part in the process of the aha moment when lots of things break over us and we say, I didn't know that, now I know it. And a lot of that is information from God that we didn't know before, which is life-transforming stuff. So there's a sense in which our rationality, our ability to remember, to process things, to think logically, to synthesize thought, all that kind of stuff is a part of the, I think, a glorious mechanism in a way that God has created into us that by which we participate in this. We're not just passive bystanders in this whole thing of God changing our lives. And then the last motive that I just wanted to mention, three, that comes to my mind is the gospel itself. It seems to me that the promise of the gospel is, look, you hurt and you long for something that you are not. And what it is that you long for, God owns. And God, unbelievable as it is going to give it to you. The very thing that you hunger and thirst for, in some even inchoate way, some ill-formed way down deep, we don't understand. But in some ill-formed way, God has given us the yearning. The quest for ultimately what we understand to be His glory, that is the participation and sharing in His glory, or His righteousness, His goodness, life. All that, it seems to me, is what this is all about. And that if we think that becoming intellectually competent or having intellectual power is something great in and of itself, then we're foolish. Nevertheless, as I said before, rationality, the fact that we are being transformed in our thinking, the way we handle life, the way we look at life, it seems to be an integral part of growing and maturing and having God change our lives. But the goal and the motive of wanting to think better as a Christian, to think more clearly, to think God's thoughts after Him, in a sense, is I desire very much to have my life be conformed to what I understand who Jesus was and what He was. And there's some intuition deep within me that tells me that righteousness, even though I only taste a little bit of it right now, is where it's at. And, let me put it this way. When we are young in our Christian faith, within a very short amount of time, we can make certain kind of judgment calls just because they're kind of basic calls about goodness and evil and morality and the parameters of certain kinds of decisions about what's good and bad for me on the basis of God's character and what he desires for me. But when life gets more complex, as we get older, as we begin to work with questions out there, whether they be academic, philosophical, or whether they just be complex human situations, it takes wisdom. You can't be righteous, you can't think righteousness, and you can't pursue godliness in a complex situation when you aren't equipped to do that. That's, it seems to me, the whole idea of wisdom being a prized thing is that a wise man or a wise woman who's lived for a while, who's lived through some of those complexities, has something to share with us who are younger because they've learned to think biblically, to think in some way much better than I can about how God would think about that. And again, thinking is involved. Discernment is involved. So the whole idea of the structure of a worldview that I started last week out of my heart comes from those kinds of motives. And the idea of a worldview is sort of just one picture, one little sort of one structure in this whole idea of what would it mean to think Christianly, to think biblically about my life and about reality, more and more all the time, hopefully. Okay, let me start with a question tonight. How do we get a worldview? Where does it come from? What are the sources of a worldview? Last week we talked about we used James Sire's little list of questions, which you have from your sheet. And we talked conceptually about what a worldview is. I'd like to suggest that a worldview comes from all kinds of sources, as I've listed here in the outline. Comes from our biophysical nature and makeup, our psychological characteristics, our inherited genetics, our physical makeup, our affective or emotional makeup, our cognitive or rational orientation, that is what kind of thinker we are, how do we tend to think very logically and mechanically in linear ways, or do we think more like I do, sort of in patterns and pictures and right brain and, I mean, all that kind of stuff. I really think that's legit. I think there really are different styles of thinking, and sometimes that makes an impact on some of the nuances and little things in our worldview, how we look at and process reality. It comes from our historical cultural environment, it comes from our family, what I've called significant others in our community or fellowship. If you're being discipled by someone, or if you're not in a Christian community as a young person, and some other older brother or someone that you look up to, some coach or tutor or someone becomes a significant person in your life, they do a lot to transform how you think about things. It comes from our socioeconomic circumstances, and it certainly is capable of coming from what I call the nation state or our ethnic background. Culture, the connections between the country we're raised in and the cultural assumptions that are embedded in that culture make a tremendous impact, and much of the time they're hidden from us. As I mentioned last week, when I went to England for the first time and lived there, I was shocked by the fact that they didn't have big refrigerators. I mean, it's a very trivial kind of thing. But I mean, literally, there was one thing right after another in a different culture that just bumped up against stuff that I took for granted in my life, and the accumulative impact of all that was great. That's called culture shock. And all that stuff was revealing hidden things in my worldview that I wasn't even aware of. Now, all of this is to say, and all I mean to say by this grocery list of things here about where our worldviews come from, is simply this. Our worldviews are a collection of beliefs and understandings. Some of them are very, very small. Some of them are assumptions that are very, very hidden. They come from all over the place. But they do, in the end, form a constellation of beliefs about me and about my world and about how things work and what ought to be and what ought not to be, all those kinds of things that we call a worldview. Now, before, I'm going to give us what I'm calling a sort of expanded framework for a worldview tonight. I want to add one more layer or one more dimension to this basic worldview outline. Remember last week, we talked about James Sire's list of seven. I think while we're going here, I'll just put him back on the board. He gave us seven worldview questions. The first one had to do with reality. What is the nature of reality? One was prime reality, and the other was what he called secondary reality. And then another question is, who or what is man, generic, mankind? What does it mean to be human would be another way to put that. What is the basis or the foundation or the criteria or whatever you want to say for morality and ethics? How do we decide what's right and wrong? How do we make the judgment? And upon what basis do we make the judgment? What is history? What is the significance of history? Is history for real? Is it cyclical? Is it linear? Is it going anywhere? Does it have any meaning? And the last one was, actually the sixth one, was what is death? What is the significance of death? Does death mean anything? Is it simply the termination of my biological viability? Or is it more significant than that? And last, how do we know? I'm going to expand this by adding another. I'm going to go in back of these questions, put it in kind of a funny way. I'd like to present four ideas here that I believe are what I would call, I mean, in my outline here, I'm calling them pre-understandings. Explain that in a second. We could also call them, one other fellow suggested that we call them axiomatic. People who are into mathematics know that their axioms are fixed rules or the rules of the game that you play mathematics with. What I mean by this is that in this section, these four beliefs, These are four beliefs which we have to assume or we don't go anywhere. And they are also assumed at such a level that we cannot really prove them. So this is often where a skeptic, historically the skeptics from the Greek philosophers on to the more sophisticated later skeptics like Hume, this is where they get a lot of their target stuff. What do I mean by this? We have to assume that we have this thing called rationality. We don't really prove it. We basically just use it. I'm not a sophisticated enough thinker or philosopher to be able to unpack it a whole lot more than that, except to say that in my looking at this issue and looking at the nature of how we know what we know, and from the people that I read on the subject, it appears that the issue of rationality is not something you can prove. It's just something you use, and you either assume it, or if you don't assume it, you immediately go into a kind of hopelessness about knowing anything. The more fancy phrase for that is sort of epistemological nihilism. Another 50-cent word or two there. Anyway, we have to assume that rationality is there. We assume, in other words, antithetical thinking. A is not the same as non-A, or its opposite. And we use this every day, obviously. When we don't come to a traffic light, look up at it and see that it's green and suggest to ourselves, well, it looks green, but I think it's red. I mean, we use antithetical thinking all the time. We're working on a roof, putting a roof on the house, and we think, there's the edge of the building. No, that's not the edge of the building. I mean, you see, this is basic stuff here. We assume antithetical thinking, or rationality, logic. Now, it's very, very popular in the modern secular university to debunk this, to say that this is a purely Western way of assuming or believing things about the world. The question I have is, okay, how else would we think about it? Explain to me how we would do that. And while they try to unpack it, they use logic to tell you about it. Mm-hmm. You see? And I think this is a part of what I would contend is what I call the fixity of the world. That is, God has created the world, creation, reality, humankind. He has created us and the world, and all this physical, material creation with a certain fixedness to it. It is a certain way, and it is not other ways. And we bump into that fixity all the time. And if we're on drugs, or if we're, you know, having an out-of-the-body experience or something, maybe we try to deal with it another way. But the fact of the matter is, you can try to deal with it another way, it just doesn't move sometimes. You know, gravity stays gravity. And we could go on about that. I don't want to beat it to death. Secondly, we assume that we exist. Again, we can sit around the table and have a philosophical discussion, and our end point will be, we aren't here. Logically, if you start with certain assumptions, you can get to that point. And there's a certain, well, we'll get into that. We really are here, folks. Okay? We assume that we exist. We assume that we can rely on our thinking. We assume that our thinking is reliable. If we don't think our thinking is reliable, that's a plausible conclusion, then we have some problems. Because we have to have reliable thinking, even at the most mundane levels of life. Again, what kinds of things do we drink? What kinds of things do we eat? You know, here's a pile of mushrooms on the table. Which one shall we eat? Oh, it doesn't matter. No, it does matter. There's a certain fixity in the universe. And if you do certain kinds of things, that leads to certain consequences. You do other things, that leads to another set of consequences. That's the way things are. And that's the way God made things. That's a very important structure, if you want to put it that way, in a dialogue with people who want to assert that we create reality for ourselves. That is, reality is simply a subjective construct. We put it together for ourselves. Truth is what I make it. And lastly, what I perceive about the world is reliable. That is, there is a reliable connection between what I think I see and what I see, what I actually see, or what I perceive. There's at least a very plausible relationship between what I am taking in about my world and the fact that I'm taking it in and perceiving it correctly. I'm not making a mistake. There's no breakdown in my taking in stuff. Now, obviously, that has some qualifications. If I see an accident and I'm standing on this corner a block away, and somebody else sees the accident and they're standing on the opposite corner but right next to the accident, they could have a real different perspective on that event than I do. I'm not saying there isn't, that there aren't interpretive possibilities in various scenarios. What I am saying is that if you got the two people together and everybody laid it out on the table, you could see, yeah, I guess I would have to back away from what I thought I saw because I was a block away. You were right there. So we can sort through that. What would be ideal, I'm saying this is ideal from a biblical point of view, would be that our thinking would be that our goal is to be as objective as possible. Objectivity, or the idea of something being objectively there, it's really there, is my starting point and what I assume about what's going on out there. But from there, depending on how complex the subject matter is that I'm dealing with, there are several factors. There are psychological factors, emotional factors. There are how much information do I have? Do I have limited information? Do I have enough information? From a Christian perspective, there is even, and I think this is quite real, there is a spiritual nature, a spiritual component to whether I want to see something or not, or whether I desire to see something that's facing me in the face. You know, Jesus said, those who have ears, let them hear, and those who have eyes, let them see. They all had eyes and they all had ears. What was he talking about? He was talking about the fact that some people don't want to hear something. Some people don't hear it because they don't want to hear it. So there's a lot of subjectivity in the process of knowing. And that, as we come to think about thinking, the goal of thinking as a Christian, I have to really factor that in, big time, because I'm no more infallible. I can be wrong just like anybody else. The difference between me and somebody else might be how seriously am I embracing the virtue of I want to know what's really true. Even if it hurts me, even if I'm wrong, I want to know what's true. And that's a moral decision that has a big impact. And I think this subjective cultural background, you know, all that personal stuff there, that subjectivity, has a big impact on how I'm going to interpret something or how well I'll do at it. All right, now these are in relation, I'm saying that I just mentioned these four things. These are sort of behind and assumed. These worldview questions, sort of, this is at level number one, level number two, or if you want to get TV-ish, we could say door number one, door number two. These are things that everybody has to assume in a way in order to really think. I mean, if they're really honest about things, even the Hindu or the Eastern pantheist thinker or the New Age thinker doesn't get very far in this ordinary, everyday, mundane world unless they more or less assume these things. At a very ordinary, mundane level, the Hindu plants his fields, puts on his pants, and drinks water, takes care of his children, just the way the Western farmer does, essentially. But when we get up into the metaphysical speculations, then we go in different directions.
Wes, I'm wondering if the pre-understandings that you're talking about have more to do with discourse about worldviews, functioning in community, because it seems to me that you could, on an intuitive level, hold a worldview without ever getting into the area of rationality.
Ever examining it critically? Or making it explicit?
Not even thinking about what you're doing.
Oh, to have
you
a world.
Live life
absolutely.
And still
absolutely.
Be manifesting a world.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Everybody has a working, viable worldview, whether they think about it or not, whether they reflect on it philosophically or not. Whether they've raised it up and said, what is this thing? Or whether they just kind of putz on and do their thing. I mean, and there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, there's some really godly, wonderful, faith-loving people who never look at the stuff the way we're looking at it. So I think you're absolutely right. I'm going to be quickly running out of time unless I make haste here. Okay, the third level, the last thing I wanted to mention, the third thing in my little diagram is, if I assume these things and I have answers to these questions or others like them, then what I'm doing, my project is, I make sense of myself and the universe that I live in. I define myself and my universe and my place in it, or at least I have some kinds of vague notions or beginning notions about how I fit into everything. Or else, I'm confused as all get out, but at least I've asked the question. I don't have the answers. But the whole project is, how do I make sense out of myself and my world, even if it's at an intuitive level? It isn't a very philosophical project. I was going to make an illustration of how worldviews work. You can envision a scenario of a public school library committee. You have a science teacher who is a raging positivist, someone who is believes absolutely religiously in the scientific method, and that's the way we really know things. An English teacher who is an existentialist, a librarian who is a humanist of the secular variety, a parent who is a New Ager, owns the local bakery, but is heavy duty into New Age stuff. And then this lonely Christian, Bible-believing folk who are on the committee. And they're going to decide what books to put in the library and what not to put in the library. Can you imagine the scenario? When we're talking basic clash worldviews, and they can get into an argument about what, you know, should we include Catcher in the Rye or, you know, Playboy magazine or something like that, and you've got all kinds of things going like this. So worldviews, one of the things that happens in that situation, if I'm a little bit aware of how worldview works, is that I begin to sort of discern, where is this person coming from? And if I begin to unpack, okay, this person has some beliefs over here that I think are these beliefs about the world, about themselves, about, you know, I can understand where they're coming from. If I can raise those up in the discussion and say and talk about the fact that we've got, look, we're believing two different things or several different things about the nature of the world and what it means to be a human being, and at least we've got down to some brass tacks here. That's not always possible in the real world, but ideally that would be great. I want to suggest that worldviews have a two-way working pattern. And this is one of my last major points here tonight. What do I mean by that? Well, let's draw my famous PBS character here. People look at the world, view reality, take in experience, and as I used the lenses last week as the world view, they look out here and they look at the world. You know, there's nature, creation, the birds, the sky, buildings, technology, cars, people, all this stuff out there, water. Anyway, they're out there interpreting all this stuff. And we're talking about how their worldview lenses that they look for are going to tell them, going to help them unpack this, discern it, negotiate it, figure out what's going on. And how they interpret this out here is going to indicate basically what their worldview pattern is. I'd like to suggest that the way worldviews work is they help us interpret what's going on out here, but reality also acts back on us. It acts back on us and our worldview such that it can alter our worldview and change us. So, for example, well, there are so many ways that the world acts on. I mean, try to imagine a world without automobiles. Try to imagine a world without... Francis Schaeffer talks about when he first moved to the little Swiss village where the Labrie community started, the women of the village used to gather down by the little stream trickling down through the mountains, and they would wash their clothes on the rocks. And there were, you know, 10, 15, 20 women at a time down there working, scrubbing their clothes and washing them on the rocks and getting them all clean and all that. And what was going on down there was not just the cleaning of the clothes, but there was community. There was shared lives. There was bearing of burdens. There was communication, knowing what was going on. There was community happening down there. And he said, as years went by and the invention of the washing machine began to make its impact and more machinery made its impact, lo and behold, this little cadre of folks in this little community washing their clothes together disappeared. So now everybody's in their own individual house, taking maybe a little less time to do it, but getting the job done apart from one another. The impact of the world, the impact of a machine, made an impact in their lives. And the same thing can happen with, out here there are tons of ideas. Ideas, books, knowledge, thought, all that stuff processed back through helps me delete from my worldview, add to my worldview, change my worldview. It's like a process that's being taken from and added to and altered all the time. Some things go, some things stay. Again, our worldviews are not fixed. They're malleable. They change. Now, in closing, let me just mention a few thoughts. I've already mentioned a couple of things, but by what criteria would we judge or decide what should be included in our worldview? From a Christian perspective, from the biblical point of view, here are some biblical thoughts that I think make an impact on our worldview. First of all, our worldviews have been affected by our rebellion and our very nature. If we come to understand our nature, then we know that we're very vulnerable to believing something that may not be true for a variety of reasons. One, we may have not enough information, we have the wrong information, or we may even have a kind of corruptness in our lives where we don't want to believe that something is true. The fall into sin and brokenness and the wrath of God cut us off from the kind of more immediate knowledge that evidently was there for Adam. And therefore, the process of getting knowledge and putting it together for ourselves is much more difficult. It's work. And remember what happened to work after the fall. There again was a corruption, a difficulty, a level of a pain to endure in order to get something from the ground to feed ourselves and to survive. And that, I think, is true for thinking and coming to knowledge. So, and we remember, of course, that our rebellion in the very nature of who we are, we can gather motives from deep within us that will justify our worldview and to our own unrighteous ends. And that happens, of course, all the time. Secondly, I think the Bible teaches us that we should be fearless about the truth, because God is the author of truth wherever it is found. Therefore, we should pursue the truth as best we can discover it, making it a part of our worldview in the process. I cannot tell you how liberating that thought is to me. I was raised in a Christian family for the most part, went to church all my life, rebelled against it in my high school years, and did my own thing, but basically was still living in a Christian kind of environment. But it wasn't until a few number of years ago that the thought came down the path to me that if the way things really are, and true truth, as Francis Schaeffer used to say, if true truth is actually the creation of God, then, and this same God is my Savior, this same God is the author of reality and the Scriptures, what is it that I have to fear? Why should I be afraid of abandoning myself to pursuing the truth? Now, I can tell you why I should be very careful, because I'm a fallen creature. And we just talked about how I could pursue something thinking it's true and then find out later I don't have enough information, I got the wrong information, I had a bad attitude, I didn't want to believe the truth when it faced me. I mean, there are all kinds of things like that. But in principle, one of the most liberating things about understanding the Christian faith is I do not fear the truth. And I need to hold that out as a beacon in front of me. My faith in Christ is not a religious dogma that bounds me to something that is static and impenetrable and cannot be such that I cannot dialogue with someone who has different ideas or someone who has seen something differently. It's simply not a problem for the Christian faith. The Bible serves as our window to God's view of reality. Therefore, as we understand the principles of life and truth in the Bible, they become the basic presuppositions and assumptions we use to think about reality and being human. I like to think about the Bible that way, that it actually has given me a window to look at the world that people who don't look at the Bible or take it seriously, that they don't have. And there are some windows, if you want to say the Bible has windows, plural, there are some windows that are so high that when I start to peek through them, even though I want to understand, it mystifies me. I don't understand some of those things. And yet the Bible has given me a glimpse of some things about God that just boggle my mind. I can hardly take it in. And yet, well, it's simply because of that, again, the idea that the Bible is giving us principles and avenues and perspectives that when the Bible is rightly interpreted, and again, that's another goal, another high standard to shoot for. We're not always right, but we need to be pursuing that. When rightly interpreted, it gives us the truth that is like looking at things, in a sense, the way God does. Therefore, inferring, therefore, that a God-given rationality that we possess and the Bible serve as authorities for determining what our worldview should be. We think about, you know, we often say, well, the Bible and the Bible alone is my authority. Well, think about that for a minute. It's true. I grant absolute authority only to the Bible. But I have to process my conclusions about the Bible through my thinking processes. And I control, in a sense, my thinking processes at the very human level. So there's a sense in which I either come to this place where I have to trust my logic and my conclusions and my thinking, maybe in a community of thinkers, hold it not so tightly that I can't give it up if I see things that are wrong with it or come to the conclusion this can't be true, but hold it in a way that is that has a certain measure of confidence to it, so that I don't have to doubt my thinking processes, what brought me to those conclusions. Since we are gifted with rationality, the following criteria should aid us in determining our worldview. I can ask the question, does all or part of my worldview perform in any of the following ways? Is my worldview consistent? That is, as I look out at the world, does my basic worldview, my answer to these questions up here, are they consistent? Does it sort of interpret everything I look at sort of consistently? Or do I find it being pieced together with different things? And that's one of the most marked characteristics of a modern mind, is that it's a fragmented mind. You find some people thinking, on the one hand, very scientifically about stuff, and we have to put it under the microscope, da-da-da-da-da, and then they'll go home and in their relationships be incredibly loosey-goosey and intuitive and, you know, touchy-feely about stuff. It's like two ways of thinking about things. Or you find people with some that have been influenced by Eastern thought, and they're also involved in the hard sciences or in law or something, and they've got to think in a certain way to play that game. And so, you know, how do you put that all together? Coherence. Does it logically fall together? Does my worldview seem to have a coherence to it? Is it comprehensive? Does it tend to explain all of my experiences? Not that there aren't some that I can't explain at a certain point, but as one person put it, is it able to gobble up large chunks of reality? That is, what it takes on, it can handle, it chews it up and handles it well, any way it faces. So it can take large chunks of reality and explain it, and has a lot of explanatory power. Now again, worldviews can be consistent and coherent and still be wrong. The question is it consistent, coherent, comprehensive, and as my last one, the congruity, does it agree with the rest of my conclusions? Does it fit? A worldview like Eastern pantheism, Eastern religion, has a comprehensive set of answers to all the questions. The question, where it breaks down, in my view, is where we come to this area of the ordinary and the mundane, because it interprets, for example, it casts off the need for rationality. Eastern religions view rationality as a lower form of thinking and being. And so you rise above it where rationality doesn't matter. Inconsistency doesn't matter. You simply, you're talking about a mode of being, rising above it in meditation and other kind with other kinds of techniques. So, all right, I need to close there. Next week, I think what I'm going to do next week, and this should be kind of fun, I'm going to bring a couple, three major worldviews, and I'm going to lay some stuff out in front of you. We're just going to have a dialogue here about some stuff, and we'll kind of have, it'll kind of be a worldview dissection laboratory, and we'll do some thinking about, we'll do some reading, and then we'll say, now, what kind of worldview are we talking about here? We'll just try to unpack this together, okay? Thank you. We're done.